This is disc number 6.
Anne, despite the glare of contempt for a sister of the light turned traitor to the cause, offered no argument. Richard thought it a rare choice on her part, and one that, at the moment, was particularly wise. "There," Nicky said, shaking a finger as she paced, barefoot. "There is the crack in the Order's imposing tower of teachings. There is the fatal flaw at the center of all convictions contrived in the imagination of men. Such things in the end, even though they may be sincere, are nothing more solid than the elaborate product of whimsy and self-deception. In the end, without the rock of reality, an insane person who hears voices in their head is equally sincere and equally credible. That is why the Order vaunts the sanctity of faith and teaches that you must dismiss the wicked impulse to use your head, that you must instead abandon yourself to your feelings. Once you surrender your life to blind faith in their account of the afterlife, they claim that then, and only then, the doorway to eternity will magically open for you and you will know all. In other words, knowledge is to be gained only through rejection of everything that actually comprises knowledge. This is why the Order equates faith with holiness, and why its absence is deemed to be sinful. This is why even questioning faith is heretical. Without faith, you see, everything they teach unravels. And since faith is the indispensable glue that binds together their teetering tower of beliefs, faith eventually gives birth to brutality. Without brutality to enforce it, faith ends up being nothing more than a fanciful daydream, or a queen's empty belief that no one will attack her throne, that no enemy will breach the borders, that no force can overthrow her defenders, if she merely forbids it. After all, I don't need to threaten you to get you to see that the water in that fountain is wet, or that the walls of this room are constructed from stone. But the Order must threaten people to make them believe that an eternity of being dead will be an eternal delight, but only if they do as they're told in this life. As she glared into the still waters of the fountain, Richard thought that Nicky's blue eyes might turn that water to ice. The cold rage in those eyes was born of things she had seen in her life that he could not begin to imagine. On the dark and quiet evenings alone with her, the things she had been willing to confide in him were terrible enough. It's a lot easier to convince people to die for your cause if you first make them eager to die, Nicky said in a bitter voice. It's a lot easier to get boys to bare their breasts to arrows and swords if they have faith that doing so is a selfless act that will make the Creator smile and welcome them into the eternal glory in the afterworld. Once the Order teaches people to be true believers, what they have really done is to forge monsters who will not only die for the cause but kill for it as well. True believers are consumed by an implacable hatred for those who don't believe. There is no more dangerous, no more vicious, no more brutal an individual than one who has been blinded by the Order's beliefs. Such a believer is not shaped by reason, so he is not bound by it. As a consequence, there is no mechanism of restraint on his hatred. These are killers who will only too happily kill for the cause, absolutely secure in the knowledge they are doing the right and the moral thing. Nicky's knuckles stood out white and bloodless as her fists tightened. Though the room seemed to ring with a sudden, terrible silence, the power of her words still echoed through Richard's mind. He thought that the strength of the aura crackling around her might provoke a sudden lightning storm within the anteroom. "As I said, the premise is pretty simple." Nicky shook her head in bitter resignation, the emotion draining from her bleak pronouncement. "For most of the people of the old world, and now the people of the new world, there is no choice but to follow the Order's teachings. If their faith wavers, they are sternly reminded of the eternity of unimaginable suffering that awaits the faithless. If that fails to work, then faith will be driven into them by the point of a sword." "But there must be some way to redeem these people," Jebra said at last. "Isn't there a way to bring them to their senses and get them to cast off the teachings of the Order?" Nicky looked away from Jebra to stare off into the distance. I was brought up from birth under the Order's teachings, and I came to my senses. Still staring off into a dark storm of memories, she fell silent for a moment, as if she were reliving her seemingly endless struggle to grasp at life, to escape the haunting clutches of the Order. But you cannot imagine how profoundly difficult it was for me to emerge from that realm of dark beliefs. I doubt that anyone who has not been lost in the suffocating world of the Order's teachings can begin to grasp what it's like to believe that your life is worthless and of no value, or grasp the shadow of terror that falls over you every time you try to turn away from what you have been taught is your only means of salvation. Her watery gaze hesitantly drifted to Richard. He knew. He had been there. He knew what it was like. I was redeemed, she whispered in a broken voice. But it was far from easy. Jebra looked encouraged by what Richard knew was no real encouragement. But it worked for you, she said. So maybe it will work for others. She is different from most of those under the spell of the Order, Richard said as he gazed into Nikki's blue eyes. Eyes that betrayed the naked emotion of how much he meant to her. She was driven by a need to understand, to know, if what she had been taught to believe was true or if there was more to life, if there was something worth living for. Most of those taught by the Order have no such doubts. They block out those kinds of questions and instead tenaciously cling to their beliefs. But what makes you think that they won't change? Jebra didn't look ready to abandon the thread of hope. If Nikki changed, then why can't others? Still gazing into Nikki's eyes, Richard said, I think they're able to block out any doubt in what they believe because they've internalized their indoctrination, no longer viewing it as specific ideas that have been drilled into them. They begin to experience the ideas they've been taught as feelings, which evolve into powerful emotional conviction. I think that's the trick to the process. They are convinced within their own minds that they are experiencing original thought rather than those discrete ideas that have been taught to them as they grew up. Nikki cleared her throat as she looked away from Richard's gaze and turned her attention once more to Jebra. I think Richard is right. I was aware of that very thing within my own thinking, aware of that inner conviction that was actually born of a carefully crafted manner of instruction. Some people who secretly value their lives will join in a revolt if they can see that there is a realistic chance to win. That's what happened in Altur Rang. But if there isn't that chance, then they know that they must repeat the words that the followers of the Order want to hear, or risk losing their most valuable possession, life. Under the Order's rule, you believe as they teach you, or you die. It's as simple as that. There are people in the old world working to join together those who will revolt, working to set the fires of freedom for those who want to seize an opportunity to control their own destiny. So there are those who truly want a chance at freedom, and will act to gain it. Jigang, too, knows of such efforts, and has sent troops to crush those revolts. But I also know only too well that most of the people of the old world would never willingly cast off their beliefs. They see doing so as sinful. They will work to ruthlessly crush any uprising. If need be, they will cling to their faith right into their graves. The once Shota irritably lifted a hand, cutting Nikki off. Yes, yes, some will, some won't. Many whiffle-waffle. It doesn't matter. Hoping for a revolt is pointless. It's just idle wishing for salvation to arrive out of the blue. The legions of soldiers from the old world are here now, in the new world. So it's the new world that we must worry about, not the old world and what the mood for revolt might or might not be. The old world, for the most part, believes in the Order, supports the Order, and encourages the Order to conquer the rest of the world. Shota glided forward, directing a meaningful look at Richard. The only way for civilization to survive is to send the invading soldiers of the Order through that doorway to their longed-for eternity in the world of the dead. There is no redeeming those whose minds are lost to beliefs they are eager to die for. The only way to stop the Order and their teachings is to kill enough of them that they can't continue. Pain does have a way of changing people's minds, Kara said. Shota gave the moored Sith a nod of approval, If they come to truly understand without any doubt that they will not win, that their efforts will lead to certain death, then perhaps some will abandon their belief and cause. It very well could be that despite their faith in the teachings of the Order, few of them actually, deep down inside, really want to die to test it. But what of it? Does that really matter to us? What we do know is that a great many really are so fanatical that they welcome death. Hundreds of thousands have already died, proving that they really are willing to make that sacrifice. The rest of these men must be killed, or they will kill us all and doom the rest of the world to a long, grinding descent into savagery. That is what we face. That is the reality of it. Chapter 16. Shota turned a hot look on Richard. Jebra has shown you what will happen at the hands of these soldiers if you don't stop them. Do you think those men entertain any rational notions of the meaning of their lives, or that they might join in a revolt against the Order if given a chance? Hardly. I'm here to show you what has already happened to many, so that you will understand what is going to happen to everyone else if you don't do something to stop it. A precise understanding of how the soldiers of the Order came to be, the choices they have made in their lives that brought them rampaging into the lives of innocent people, and the reasons behind those choices are beyond being our concern. They are what they are. They are destroyers, killers. They are here. That is all that matters now. They must be stopped. If they are dead, they will cease to be a threat. It's as simple as that. Richard wondered how in the world she expected him to accomplish such a simple thing. She might as well be asking him to pull the moon down out of the sky and use it to crush the Imperial Order army. As if reading his mind, Nikki spoke up again. We may all agree with you, with everything you have come here to say, and in fact we didn't need you to tell us what we already know, as if you think us children and only you are wise. But you don't understand what you're asking. The army that Jebra saw, the army that marched up into Galea and so easily crushed their defenses and killed so many people, is a minor and rather insignificant unit of the Imperial Order. You can't be serious, Jebra said. Nikki finally withdrew her glare from Shota and looked at Jebra. Did you see any gifted?
Gifted?
Why, no, I guess not, she said after a moment's thought. That's because they didn't warrant having their own gifted to command, Nikki said. If they had gifted, Shota would not have been able to so easily get in there and then take you right out of the place. But they had no gifted. They're a relatively minor force, and as such, they're considered expendable. That's why the supplies took so long to reach them. All supplies first went north to Jigang's main force. Once they had what they needed, they then allowed supplies to go to other units, like the one up in Galea. They are only one of Jigang's expeditionary forces.
But you don't understand, Jebra stood. They were a huge army. I was there. I saw them with my own eyes.
She dry-washed her hands as she glanced around at everyone in the room.
I was there, working for them month after month. I saw how massive their numbers were. How could I not grasp the extent of their forces? I've told you about all they accomplished.
Unimpressed, Nikki shook her head. They were nothing. Jebra licked her lips, distress settling into her expression. Perhaps I have not done an adequate job of describing it, of making clear just how many soldiers of the Order invaded Galea. I'm sorry that I failed in making you understand how easily they crushed all those determined defenders.
You did a very good job of reporting accurately what you saw, Nikki said in a gentler tone as she squeezed the woman's shoulder in sympathetic reassurance. But you only saw a part of the whole picture. The part you saw, frightening as it surely was insignificant compared to the rest of it. What you saw could not begin to prepare you for seeing the main force led by Emperor Jigang.
I have spent a great deal of time in Jigang's main encampments. I know what I'm talking about. Compared to their main force, the one you saw does not qualify as imposing.
She's right, Zed said in a grim voice. I hate to admit it, but she's right. Jigang's main army is vastly more powerful than the one that invaded Galea. I fought to slow their advance up through the Midlands as they steadily drove us back toward Identril, so I ought to know. Seeing them come is like watching the approach of uncountable minions of the underworld come to swallow the living. He looked stoic in his simple robes, standing at the top of the five steps, watching, listening to what others had to say. Richard knew, though, that his grandfather was anything but indifferent. Zed's way was often to listen to what others had to say before he had his say. In this instance, there was no need for him to correct anything that he'd heard. "If the order troops in Galia have no gifted," Jebra said, "then perhaps if some of those with the gift were to go there, you could eliminate them. Perhaps you could save those poor people who are still alive, who have endured so much. It is not too late to at least save some of them." Richard thought that what she was really asking, but feared to speak aloud, was if this was only a minor force with no gifted among them, then why hadn't some of those present done something to stop the slaughter she'd witnessed? Before Richard had ever left his woods of Heartland, he might very well have harbored the same vague sense of resentment and anger towards those who had not done anything to save them. Now, he felt the torment of knowing how much more there was to it. Nikki shook her head, dismissing the idea. "It's not so feasible as it might seem. The gifted might be able to take out a large number of the enemy and for a time create havoc. But even this expeditionary force has sufficient numbers to withstand any attack by the gifted. Zed, for example, could use wizard's fire to mow down ranks of soldiers. But as he paused to conjure more, the enemy would be sending wave upon wave of men at him. They might lose a lot of men, but they are not deterred by staggering casualties. They would keep coming. They would throw rank after rank of men into the conflagration. Despite how many would die, they would soon enough overwhelm even one as talented as the first wizard. And then where would we be? Even something as simple as a band of archers could take down a gifted person." She glanced at Richard. "All it takes is one arrow finding its mark, and a gifted person will die the same as any other." Zed spread his hands in a gesture of frustration. "I'm afraid that Nikki is right. In the end, the order would be in the same place with the same result, even if with fewer men. We, on the other hand, would be without those with the gift that we sent against them. They can replenish their troops with nearly endless reinforcements, but there will be no legions of gifted coming to our aid. As callous as it may seem, our only chance lies not with throwing our lives away in a futile battle that we know has no chance of success, but with being able to come up with something that has a real chance to work." Richard wished that he believed that there was some solution, some plan, that had a real chance to work. He didn't think, though, that there was any chance that they could do anything other than prolong the end. Jebra nodded, her glimmer of hope sparking out. The deep creases that lent a sagging look to her face, along with the lasting web of wrinkles at the corners of her blue eyes, made her look older than Richard suspected she really was. Her shoulders were slightly rounded, and her hands rough and calloused from hard labor. Even though the men of the Order had not killed her, they had sapped the life out of her, leaving her forever scarred by what she had been through and what she'd been forced to witness. How many others were there like her? Alive, but forever withered under the brutality of the occupying forces, hollow shells of their former selves. Alive on the outside, but lifeless inside. Richard felt dizzy. He could hardly believe that Shota would bring Jebra all this way to convince him of how terrible the Order really was. He already knew the truth of their brutality, of the nature of their threat. He'd lived for nearly a year in the old world under the repression of the Order. He had been there at the start of the revolt in Alto Rang. Jebra's first-hand testimony, if anything, was only helping to convince him of what he already knew, that they didn't stand a chance against Chigang and the Imperial Order forces. The entire Dharan Empire would probably have been able to stop the unit that had descended upon Galia, but that was nothing compared to the main army of the Imperial Order. Back when he'd first met Kaelin, he'd fought hard to stop the threat to everyone brought by Darkan Rall. As difficult as it had been, Richard had been able to end that threat by eliminating Darkan Rall. He knew, though, that this threat was different. As much as he hated Chigang, Richard knew that he could not think of this in the same terms as the last battle. Even if he could somehow kill Chigang, that would not stop the menace of the Imperial Order. Their cause was monolithic, ideological, not driven by the ambitions of one individual. That was what made it all seem so hopeless. Shota's vision, what she foresaw in the flow of time as the world's hopeless future if they failed to do something to stop the Imperial Order, certainly didn't seem to Richard to have required any great talent or special sight. He didn't need to be a prophet to see how dire a threat the Order was. If not stopped, they would rule the world. Jebra, in that sense, had told him nothing new, nothing that he didn't already know. Richard recognized all too well that, the way things stood, when the forces of the Dharan Empire finally met Jagang's army in the final battle, those brave men, who were all that stood in the Order's way, were all going to die. After that, there would be no opposition to the Imperial Order. They would rampage unchecked, and in the end, they would rule the world. Shota was far from stupid, so she obviously knew all that, and had to know that he would know it as well. So, he wondered, why was she really there? Despite his dark mood over Jebra's frightening account of what she had seen, Richard had to think that Shota very likely had some other reason for her visit. Still, Jebra's story had been difficult to listen to without it stirring not only his anguish, but his anger. Richard turned away and stared into the stilled water of the fountain. He felt the weight of gloom settling around his shoulders. What could he do about any of it? It felt as if this and all the other troubles pressing in around them were pushing Kaelin away from his thoughts, away from him. At times, she hardly even seemed real to him. He hated it whenever he had such a thought. Sometimes, when he remembered her wit, or the way she smiled so easily when she rested her wrists on his shoulders and locked her fingers together behind his neck and gazed at him, or her beautiful green eyes, or her soft laugh, or her touch, or the tight smile she gave no one but him. She seemed more like a phantom who existed solely in his imagination. The very thought of Kaelin not being real sent a spike of tingling dread surging up through his insides. He had lived with that numbing fear for a long, dark period. It had been terrifying to be alone in his belief that she existed, terrifying to doubt his own sanity, until he had at last found the truth of the Chainfire spell and convinced the others that she was indeed real. Now, at least, he had their help. Richard mentally shook himself. Kaelin was no phantom. He had to find a way to get her out of the clutches of Sister Ulysia and the other two Sisters of the Dark. It didn't help, though, that the thought of Kaelin being a captive of such ruthless women caused him such anguish that he sometimes couldn't bear to think about it, to think of what terrible things they might do to the woman who was his world, the woman he loved more than life itself. And yet he could not make his mind focus on anything else. Despite what Shota believed he should do, Richard had to remember that besides Kaelin being lost in the vortex of the Chainfire spell, there were other ominous dangers, like the Boxes of Warden being in play, and the damage left behind by the chimes. He couldn't ignore everything else just because the witchwoman came marching in to tell him what she thought he should do. It could even be that Shota's true goal was some complex scheme, some hidden agenda, involving this other witchwoman, Six. There was no telling what Shota was really up to. Still, Richard had come to have great respect for her, as had Kaelin, even if he didn't entirely trust her. While Shota often seemed to be an instigator of trouble, it was not necessarily because she was deliberately trying to cause him grief. Sometimes her intent was to help him, and at other times she was simply the messenger of truth. And while she was always right in the things she revealed to him, those things almost always turned out to be true in ways Shota hadn't predicted, or at least in ways she hadn't revealed. As Zed often said, a witchwoman never told you something you wanted to know without also telling you something you didn't want to know. The first time he met her, Shota had said that Kaelin would touch him with her power, and so he should kill her to prevent that from happening. As it turned out, Kaelin did use her confessor's touch on him, but that was how he had been able to trick Darkan Rahl and defeat him. Shota had been right, but it had happened in a manner that turned out to be vastly different from the way she'd presented it. Even though she had been right, strictly speaking, if he had followed her advice, Darkan Rahl would have survived to unleash the power of Warden and rule them all, or the ones left alive.
In the back of his mind lurked the prediction Shota had made that if Richard married Kaelin, she would bear a child that would be a monster. He and Kaelin had been wed.
Surely that prediction would not turn out the way Shota had presented it either. Surely Kaelin would not give birth to a monster.
It was Zed who finally spoke, bringing Richard out of his private thoughts.
Whatever happened to Queen Cirilla?
The room was dead still for a time before Jebra answered.
It was as it had been in my vision. She was handed over to the lowest of the soldiers to use as they wished. They were eager to get at their prize. It went very badly for her. Her worst fears came to pass.
Zed cocked his head, apparently believing that there was more to the story.
So that was the last you saw of her?
Jebra folded her hands before herself.
Not exactly.
One day, as I was rushing to deliver a platter of freshly roasted beef, I came upon a raucous group of men playing a game that the Imperial Order troops were very fond of watching. There were two teams with the gathered men shouting and yelling them on. The men were all betting on which team would win. I don't know what the game was.
Chala,
Nikki said.
When Jebra turned to look at her, Nikki said, "The game is called Jala. In theory, it's a game of athletic ability, skill, and strategy. In practice, under the rules the Order plays it by, Jala is all of that, and in addition, it's quite brutal. Jala is Jagang's favorite sport. He has a team of his own. I remember once when they lost a game. The whole team was put to death. The Emperor soon had a new team of the most skilled, toughest, most physically imposing players to be found. They did not lose. The full name of the game is Jala de Jin. In Emperor Jagang's native tongue, it means the game of life."
Jebra frowned in recollection.
"Yes, I guess I do recall hearing it called Jala.
I always saw it played with a heavy ball. A ball heavy enough to, on occasion, break the bones of the players."
"The ball is called a brock," Richard said without turning.
Nikki glanced over at him.
"That's right." "Well," Jebra said, resuming her story, "on this particular day, as I was taking the platter to the commanders, I had to go to the place where the game was being played. There were thousands of troops gathered to watch. I was directed to a small stand for the commanders, and had to make my way through the cheering throngs. It was a terrifying journey. The men saw the iron ring of a slave in my lips, so none dared to pull me away to their tents. But that didn't stop their hands on me."
Jebra's gaze sought the floor. "It was something that I had to endure often enough." She finally looked up. "When I reached the commanders, down close to the playing field, I saw that the men starting up a new game weren't using the ball that they usually used." She cleared her throat. "They were using Queen Cirilla's head for the ball."
Jebra sought to fill the uncomfortable silence. "Anyway, life in Galea had been changed forever. What was once a center of commerce is now little more than a vast army camp from where continuing campaigns against some of the free areas of the New World are launched. The farms out in the country, run by forced labor, don't produce as they once did. Crops fail or are poor. The needs of the vast armed forces in Galea are huge. Food is always scarce, but the supplies that regularly come up from the old world keep the soldiers fed well enough to carry on. I worked day and night as a slave to the needs of the Imperial Order commanders. I never again had any visions after the one about Queen Cirilla. It seemed odd to me to be without my visions. I'd had them my whole life, but after that terrible vision about Queen Cirilla a couple of years back, no more came. My gift as a seer seems to have vanished. My vision has gone dark." By the glance from Nikki, Richard knew that she suspected what he was thinking.
"Eventually," Jebra said, "I was one day snatched away from the middle of all those troops. It was Shota who somehow got me out. I'm not entirely sure how it happened. I just recall that she was there with me. I started to ask something, but she told me to keep my mouth shut and to start walking. I remember turning back once to look,
and there was the army spread out across the valley and up into the hills, but they were a great distance behind us. I don't know how it had happened, really, that we were so far away. She frowned into her dim memories. We were just walking, and here I am. I'm afraid, though, that because my visions have gone dark, I can no longer be of any help to you. Richard thought she should know the truth, so he told her. Your vision probably went dark because several years back the chimes were in this world for a time. They were banished back to the underworld, but the damage was done. I think that the presence of the chimes in the world of life began the disintegration of magic. It must be that it disrupted your ability. Your gifted vision is probably lost, or even if it returns in part or for a time, it will eventually be completely extinguished. Jebra looked dazed by the news. My whole life I have frequently wished that I had never been born with the vision of a seer. In many ways it made me an outcast. I often wept at night, wishing to be free of my visions, wishing they would leave me be. But now that you tell me that my wish has been granted, I don't think that I ever really meant it. That's the problem with wishes, Zed said as he sighed. They tend to be things that... The chimes? Shota interrupted. By her tone of voice, as well as her frown, Richard knew that she wasn't interested in hearing about wishes. If such a thing were true, then why has there been no other evidence of it? There has been, Richard said with a shrug. Creatures of magic, such as the dragons, have not been seen in the last couple of years.
Dragons?
Shota coiled a long, wavy lock of hair around a finger as she appraised him silently for a moment. Richard, people can go for a lifetime and never catch a glimpse of a dragon. And what of Jebra's visions going dark? After the chimes were in this world, her vision ceased. Like other things of magic, her unique ability is flickering out. I'm sure that we aren't even aware of most of them. I would be aware of them. Not necessarily. Richard raked his hair back from his forehead. The problem is, Chainfire, which I first heard about from you, is a spell that was ignited by four Sisters of the Dark to make everyone forget Kaelin. That spell is contaminated by the chimes, so besides Kaelin, people are forgetting other things as well, such as dragons. Shota looked anything but convinced. I would still be aware of such things because of the way they flow forward in time. And what about this other witch woman, Six? I thought that you said that she was masking your ability to see the flow of time. Shota ignored his question and pulled the finger free of the skein of auburn hair. As she folded her arms, her almond-shaped eyes remained fixed on him. If the shadow of the Order darkens mankind, none of it will matter now, will it? They will put an end to all magic, as well as all hope. Richard didn't answer. Instead, he turned to the still waters, to his brooding thoughts. Shota tilted her head, gesturing toward the steps as she spoke quietly to Jebra. Go up there and see Zed. I need to talk to Richard. Chapter 17. As Shota glided closer to Richard, she cast Nikki a threatening glare. He wondered why Shota hadn't also told Nikki to go back up the steps with Jebra to talk to Zed. He surmised, though, that the witchwoman probably knew that Nikki wouldn't follow any such orders. He certainly didn't want to see them in a test of wills. He had enough to worry about without those on the same side battling among themselves. When Richard glanced over and saw Jebra ascending the steps, he also saw that Anne and Nathan had already made their way around the room to stand near Zed as well. When she reached him, Zed circled a comforting arm around Jebra's shoulders as he murmured words of reassurance. But his gaze was on Richard. Richard appreciated his grandfather watching out for him and keeping an eye on the witch woman just in case she had any ideas about pulling one of her tricks. Zed probably knew far better than any of them just what Shota was capable of. He also harbored a deep mistrust of the woman, not sharing at all Richard's view that Shota, at her core, was driven by the same convictions as they were. As much as he might appreciate her central purpose, Richard was well aware that Shota sometimes pursued that purpose in ways that had in the past caused him no end of grief. What she viewed as help sometimes ended up being nothing but trouble for him. He was all too aware that Shota also on occasion had her own agenda, such as when she had given the sword to Samuel. Richard suspected that she was up to something now as well. He just didn't know what or what was behind it. He wondered if it might have something to do with eliminating the other witch woman.
"Richard," Shota said in a soft, sympathetic tone, "you have heard the nature of the terror that is descending upon us. You are the only one who can stop it. I don't know why it is so, but I do know that it is." Richard did not spare her for her gentle tone or her concern about their common enemy. "You dare to express your deep distress over the suffering and death brought by the Order, and your conviction that only I can do something to stop the threat. And yet you conspired to withhold information just so that you could wrest the Sword of Truth from me?"
She didn't rise to the challenge. "There was no conspiring, as you put it. It was a fair trade, value for value." Her voice remained serene. "Besides, the sword would not be of any help to you in this, Richard. A poor excuse for you giving it to that murderous Samuel."
Shota arched an eyebrow. "And, as it turns out, had I not, then those Sisters of the Dark who stole the boxes of Warden would probably have united by now. With all three boxes together, they very well might have already opened one, very well might have already unleashed the power of Orton, very well might have already turned us all over to the Keeper of the Dead. What good would the sword do you if the world of life were ended? It seems that Samuel, for whatever reason, has prevented a cataclysm. Samuel also used the sword to kidnap Rachel. In the process, he nearly killed Chase, and apparently intended to.
Use your head, Richard. The sword served us all by buying us time, even if it was at a cost that none of us likes. What are you going to do with the time you now have that you otherwise would not? More to the point, what good would the sword do you now against the threat of the Order? Besides, with the sword anyone can be a seeker, a pretend seeker anyway. A true seeker does not need the sword to be the seeker." He knew that she was right. What would he do with the sword? Try to cut down the Imperial Order single-handedly? Just as Nikki had explained to Jebra how those with the gift could not overcome vast numbers just because they could wield magic, the same applied to the sword. Still, Shota had given the sword to Samuel, and now Samuel seemed to be acting on the orders of a different witchwoman, one who apparently had no one's interest at heart but her own. Worse, what sense did it make to fret over a single weapon when so many were dying at the hands of the Order, when that single weapon would not preserve their lives or freedom? Richard knew that the sword was not the real weapon. The mind that directed it was what really mattered. He was the true seeker. He was the true weapon. Samuel couldn't take that. And yet, he had no idea what to do to stop the threat, to halt any of the dangers closing in around them. Nikki stood not far away, distant enough to give Shota her chance to talk to him, but close enough to step between them in an instant if the talk turned to threats or to something Nikki didn't like. Richard stared into Nikki's blue eyes a moment before turning again to meet Shota's gaze. "And just what is it that you expect me to do?" Without being aware of her coming closer, he suddenly realized that he could feel Shota's breath against his cheek. It carried the faint scent of lavender. The fragrance felt as if it drew the tension right out of him.
"What I expect," Shota said in an intimate whisper as her arm slipped around his waist, "is for you to understand. To truly understand." Distantly alarmed by what might be her veiled intent, Richard thought that he should back out of her firm embrace. Before he could move a muscle, Shota lifted his chin with a finger. In an instant, he was kneeling in the mud. The sound of the steady downpour roared around him, drumming on the roofs and awnings, pattering in the puddles, spattering mud on the walls of the buildings, on broken carts, and on the legs of the milling mob. Soldiers in the distance shouted orders. Bony horses, their heads hanging, their legs caked with mud, looked miserable as they stood impassively in the rain.
A group of soldiers off to the side laughed among themselves, while some others not far away chatted in trivial, bored conversation. Nearby wagons rumbled and bounced as they rolled slowly down a road, while in the distance a few dogs barked ceaselessly in a manner born of habit. In the gloomy light of the leaden overcast, everything looked a murky shade of grayish-brown. When he glanced to his right, Richard saw that there were other men lined up, kneeling in the mud beside him. Their drab, sodden clothes hung limp from slumped shoulders. Their faces were ashen, their eyes wild with fright. Behind them lurked the maw of a deep pit, looking like nothing so much as a dark opening into the underworld itself. With a growing sense of urgency, Richard tried to move, to shift his balance, so that he could scramble to his feet and defend himself. It was then that he realized his wrists were bound behind his back with what felt like leather thongs. When he tried to twist out of the tightly wound bindings, the leather cut deeper into his flesh. He ignored the searing pain and strained with all his might, but he could not break free. An old dread of being helpless with his hands tied welled up in him. All around him towered hulking soldiers, some in armor made of leather or out of rusty metal discs or chain mail, while still others wore nothing more protective than crude hide vests. Their weapons hung from wide belts and studded straps. None of the weapons were ornate. They were simple tools of their trade, knives with homemade wooden handles riveted onto the heels of the blades, swords with leather wound around wooden grips to hold them to the tangs, maces made of crudely cast iron atop a stout hickory handle or wrought iron bar. Their coarse construction made them no less effective for their task. If anything, the lack of adornment served to emphasize their only purpose, and in so doing only made them look all the more sinister. The greasy hair of those who didn't shave their heads was matted by the steady rain. Some soldiers had multiple rings or sharpened metal posts in their ears and nose. The grime layering their faces appeared impervious to the rain. Many a man had a swath of a dark tattoo across his face. Some of the tattoos were almost like masks, while others swept over cheek and nose and brow in wild, snaking, dramatic designs. The bold tattoos made the men look all the less human, all the more savage. The eyes of the soldiers flicked back and forth, seldom pausing on any one thing, giving the men the look of restless animals. Richard had to blink the rainwater out of his eyes to see. He tossed his head, flicking strands of his wet hair back off his face. It was then that he saw men to his left as well, some weeping helplessly as soldiers held up those who would not or could not kneel upright in the sloppy mud. The sense of panic was palpable. The floodwaters of that panic spread to Richard, rising up through him, threatening to drown him. This wasn't real, he knew, but somehow it was. The rain was cold. His clothes were soaked. An occasional shiver rattled through him. The place stank worse than anything he could ever remember, a combination of acrid smoke, stale sweat, excrement, and putrefying flesh. The cries of those around him were all too real. He didn't think he would have been able to imagine moans so devoid of hope, and at the same time so desperately frightened. Many of the men trembled uncontrollably, and it wasn't from the cold rain. Richard realized, as he stared at them, that he was one of them, much the same as them, just one of the many on their knees in the mud, one of many with their hands bound behind their backs. It was so impossible that it was disorienting. Somehow he was there. Somehow Shota had sent him to this place. He could not conceive of how such a thing could be possible. He had to be imagining it. A rock hidden beneath the mud dug painfully into his left knee. Such an unforeseeable, trivial detail seemed like it had to be real. How could he possibly imagine something so unexpected? He tried to shift his weight, but it was difficult to balance. He managed to push his knee to the side a little, off the sharp rock. He couldn't be imagining such a thing. He began to wonder if it was everything else that he had actually been imagining. He wondered if it all had just been a dream, a diversion, a trick of his mind. He began to wonder if it could be possible that the chain fire spell had somehow made him forget what was really happening, or if reality was just so terrifying that he had somehow blocked it out of his mind, withdrawing to an imaginary world, and now, suddenly, under the stress of the situation, he had snapped back to what was real. He began to realize that even if he didn't know exactly what was going on, or how he could be so confused, what really mattered was that this actually was real, and somehow he was only now awakening to it. In fact, that's just what it felt like to him, like he had just awakened, disoriented and confused. If he had been confused before, now he was desperately trying to remember, to understand how he had come to be where he found himself, how he had ended up on his knees in the mud among Imperial Order soldiers. It seemed like he could almost remember how he had gotten there, almost recall it all, but it remained just out of reach, like a forgotten word that was lost somewhere in the dark well of the mind. Richard looked down the line to his left and saw a soldier grab a fistful of a man's hair and yank his head upright. The man screamed, short, terror-choked sounds driven by a heaving chest. Richard could easily see that despite the man's frantic effort, he had no chance of escape. The sounds of his tearful pleas raised goosebumps on Richard's arms. The soldier behind the kneeling man brought a long, thin knife around in front of the man's exposed throat. Again, Richard tried to tell himself that he had been right before, that it wasn't real, that he was somehow just imagining it. But he could see the chip in the blade of the crudely honed knife, see the man swallowing over and over in panting panic, see the grim grin on the soldier's smug face. When the knife sliced deep across the man's throat, Richard flinched in shock at the sight, as the man flinched with the shock of pain. The man thrashed, but the soldier holding him by the hair had no trouble restraining his victim. The rain-slicked muscles of his powerful arm bulged as he exerted more effort to cut down through the man's throat a second time, far deeper, and nearly all the way around. Blood, shockingly crimson in the gray light, gushed out with each beat of the man's still-throbbing heart. Richard winced as the fresh smell of it made his nostrils flare. He tried to tell himself that it wasn't real. Yet somehow, as he watched the man weakly twisting, watched as a bib of blood grew down the front of his shirt, soaked down the crotch of his pants, it was all too real. With one final effort, his neck gaping open, the man kicked his right leg out to the side. The soldier, still holding the man by the hair, heaved him back into the pit. Richard heard the dead weight splash down heavily in the bottom. Richard's heart pounded against his chest wall so hard that he thought it might burst. He felt sick. He thought he might vomit. He strained frantically to wrench his hands free, but the leather only cut deeper into his flesh. The rain was washing sweat into his eyes. The leather thongs had been in place for so long that just moving against them burned painfully enough into the raw wounds to bring fresh tears to his eyes. That didn't stop him, though. He grunted with effort, putting all his muscle into the struggle to break his bonds. He could feel the leather rasping against the exposed tendons in his wrists. And then Richard heard his name called out. He instantly recognized the voice. It was Kalin. His whole life hammered to a halt when he looked up, across the way and into her dazzling green eyes. Every emotion he had ever had washed through him in an instant, leaving behind a kind of weak and terrible agony that ached all the way down to the marrow of his bones. He had been separated from her for so long. Seeing her, seeing every detail of her face, seeing the little arch and the wrinkle in her brow that he had forgotten about, seeing the exact way her back curved as she stood turned slightly, seeing the way her hair parted naturally under the weight of the rain, seeing her eyes, her beautiful green eyes, told him that he could not possibly be imagining it. Kalin stretched out an arm. Richard! The sound of her voice paralyzed him. It had been so long since he had heard her singular voice, a voice that from the first time he'd met her had riveted him with its intelligence, its clarity, its grace, its bewitching charm. But now there was none of that in her voice. All those qualities had been stripped away until all that was left was anguish beyond bearing. Matching the distress in her voice, Kaylin's exquisite features twisted in horror at seeing him kneeling in the mud. Her eyes were rimmed with red. Tears streamed down her cheeks along with the rain. Richard knelt frozen in terror, frozen at the sight of her, right there, so close yet so far. Frozen to discover that she was there in the middle of thousands upon thousands of enemy troops. Richard! Her arm desperately stretching for him again. She was trying to get to him, but she couldn't. She was being held back by a burly soldier with a shaved head. Richard noticed for the first time that the buttons on Kaylin's shirt were gone, ripped off, so the shirt hung open, exposing her to the leers of the soldiers. But she didn't care. She only wanted Richard to see her, as if that was all that mattered in life, as if that single sight of him was her whole life, as if she needed only that to live. A painful knot swelled in his throat. Tears welled up. Richard whispered her name, too shocked by the sight of her to bring forth more. Frantic, Kaylin again reached out for him, straining against the restraint of the soldier's meaty hand. His tight grip left white prints of his fingers in the flesh of her arm. Richard! Richard, I love you! Dear spirits, I love you! As she tried to tear away, to lunge toward him, the soldier circled a powerful arm around her middle, inside her open shirt, holding her back. The man reached around and with a finger and thumb seized Kaylin's nipple, twisting it as he glanced up, grinning with meaning, making sure that Richard saw what he was doing. A small cry of surprised pain escaped Kaylin's throat, but otherwise she ignored the soldier, instead screaming Richard's name in abject terror. Fired by rage, Richard furiously tried to get to his feet. He had to get to her. The soldier laughed as he watched Richard struggle. There was no way another chance would come along. This was it. This would be his only chance. As he began to force his way to his feet, a guard rammed a boot into Richard's gut so hard that it doubled him over. Another soldier kicked him in the side of the head for good measure, stunning him nearly senseless. The world dimmed. Sound melted into a dull drone. Richard struggled to remain conscious. He didn't want to lose sight of Kaylin. There was no sight in the whole world that meant more to him than the sight of her. He had to find a way to get her out of the middle of this nightmare. As he fought to regain his breath, the big fist of a soldier seized his hair and yanked him upright. Richard gasped, trying to draw a breath against the stupefying pain of the blows. He felt warm blood running down the side of his face, washing cold mud down his neck. As his head was pulled upright, Richard's gaze fell on Kaylin again, on her long hair now tangled and matted by the rain. Her green eyes were so beautiful that he thought his heart might burst with the pain of seeing her again, but not being able to hold her in his arms. He wanted so badly to hold her in his arms, to comfort her, to protect her. Instead, another man was holding her in his arms. She tried to squirm away. He cupped her breast, squeezing until Richard could see that it was hurting her. She beat at him with her fists, but he held her fast. He laughed at her futile efforts as his gaze again slid to Richard. Kaylin fought him, but at the same time ignored what he was doing, ignored the distraction. What he was doing was not what mattered most to her. Richard was what mattered most. Her arms frantically stretched out toward him. "Richard, I love you. I've missed you so much." She was overcome with sobs of sheer misery. "Dear spirits, help him, please! Somebody help him!" To his left, the next man in line tried with all his might to back away as his throat was sliced deep. Richard could hear the man's frantic gasps gurgling through the gash that opened up his windpipe. Richard felt faint with panic. He didn't know what to do. Magic! He should call his gift. But how was he to do that? He didn't know how to call forth magic. And yet, in the past, he had been able to do it. Rage. In the past, his gift had always worked through his anger. Seeing the soldier holding Kaylin, hurting her, provided him with more than enough anger. Seeing another of those monsters come in close to her, leering down at her, touching her intimately, only fanned the wild flames of his anger. His world went red with rage.
With every fiber of his being, Richard tried to ignite his gift with the essence of that fury. He clenched his jaw, gritting his teeth with the monumental concentration of his wrath. He shook with rage, expecting an explosion of power to match that rage. He saw what he needed to do. It seemed so close. He imagined it cutting down the soldiers. He held his breath against the storm that was about to be unleashed. It felt like falling unexpectedly, without any ground below him to catch his fall. The rain continued to plunge from the gray sky as if to drown his effort. No magic arced through the empty space between Richard and the man who held Kaelin. No conjured lightning erupted. No justice was at hand. In all his life, if there was anything there, this was the moment it would have come. That much he knew beyond any doubt. There could be no more urgent need, no more desire, no more wrath for the woman he loved. But no power was there, no redemption at hand. He might as well have been born without the gift. He had no gift. It was gone. It felt to Richard as if the world was caving in around him. He wanted everything to slow down, to give him time to find a solution. But everything swirled in a terrible rush. It was all happening too fast. It was so unfair to have to die like this. He hadn't had a chance to live, to have a life with Kaelin. He loved her so much, and he hadn't really been able to be with her, just the two of them, living in peace. He wanted to smile and laugh with her, to hold her, to go through life with her, just to sit in front of a fire with her on a cold, snowy night, holding her close to him, safe and warm, as they talked about the things that mattered to them, about their future. They should have a future. It was so unfair. He wanted to live his life. Instead, it was to end in this miserable place for no good reason, for nothing. He wasn't even able to make his death mean something, to die fighting for life. Instead, he was going to die here in the rain and mud, surrounded by men who hated all that was good in life, while Kaelin was forced to watch it happen. He didn't want her to see this. He knew that she would never be able to get the sight of it out of her mind. He didn't want to leave her with that last horrific memory of him struggling in the bloody throes of death. He made another attempt to get up, as did most of the other men. The soldier behind him stepped on his calves, bearing down with all his weight. The pain felt distant. Richard was in a daze. He wanted nothing in the world so much as to get Kaelin away from the men who were holding her, groping her. Kaelin screamed in rage at them, clawed at them, swung her fists at them, and at the same time cried in helpless terror for Richard. He twisted with all his might against the leather thongs binding his wrists, but rather than part, they only cut deeper. He felt like an animal caught in a trap. His hands had gone numb. He could no longer feel the warm blood dripping off his fingertips. He didn't want to die. What was he to do? He had to stop this. Somehow he had to. But he didn't know how. In the past, anger was the means to reach his gift, to call forth its power. Now there was nothing but a helpless confusion. Kaelin! He couldn't seem to help himself from being swept up in the terror of it, in the blind panic of it. He couldn't stop the headlong rush of it, couldn't regain his sense of control over himself. He was being swept away in a river of events he could not control or stop. It was all so senseless. It was all so overwhelmingly pointless, so monumentally brutal. Kaelin! Richard! She cried as she again reached out for him. Richard, I love you more than life. I love you so much. You're everything to me. You always have been. Sobs caught her breath, turning them to gasps. Richard, I need you so badly. His heart was breaking. He felt that he was failing her. A soldier seized Richard by the hair. No! Kaelin screamed, holding out a hand. No, please, no! Somebody please help him! Dear spirit, somebody please! The soldier leaned down, a cruel smile twisting his grime-streaked face. Don't worry, I'll see to her. Personally. He laughed in Richard's ear. Please, Richard heard himself say. Please, no. "Dear spirits, please, somebody help him!" Kaelin cried to those around her.
She could do nothing, and she knew it. There was no chance for him, and she knew it. She was reduced to begging for a miracle. That in itself fed the flames of hot dread burning out of control within him. This was the end of everything.
"She's a real looker," the soldier said as he leered across the way at Kaelin, proving what Richard knew, that no miracle was at hand. "Please, leave her be." The soldier behind him laughed. That was what he had wanted to hear. Richard was choking on the sob welling up in his throat. He couldn't breathe past it. Tears ran down his face along with the rain. She was the only woman he had ever loved, the one person who meant everything to him, meant more than life itself to him. Without Kaelin there was no life, there was only existence. She was his world. Without Kaelin life was empty. Without him, he knew, Kaelin's life would be just as empty. He saw other women not far from Kaelin, all being held by soldiers, all screaming for their men. He saw them saying things much like the things Kaelin was saying, offering the same words of love, the same calls for someone to save them. The soldiers taunted the men kneeling in the mud with vile oaths. Seeing the women in the hands of the soldiers, one of the kneeling men to Richard's right struggled hard enough to earn himself a lightning-quick stab to the gut. It didn't kill him, but it was enough to keep him from fighting while he was made to wait his turn. As he knelt stiff and still, his wide eyes stared down at his own pink, glistening inside slowly bulging out of the gash. The screams of the man's wife seemed like they could have split the clouds above. The man immediately to Richard's left gasped his last breath, thrashing in uncoordinated movements as the soldier holding up the man's head sawed the large knife back and forth across the victim's exposed throat. When finished, the soldier growled with the effort of heaving the dead weight back into the open pit. Richard heard the body thud down in the bottom of the open grave atop other bodies. He could hear gurgling gasps coming from the dark hole.
"Your turn," the soldier holding Richard said as he stepped around behind him to assume the role of executioner.
The man leaned close. His breath stank of ale and sausage.
"I need to finish this. I've a meeting with your lovely wife as soon as I'm done with you. Kaelin, isn't it?"
"Yes, that's right. One of the other women confessed that her wife's name was Kaelin. Don't you worry, lad. I won't give Kaelin much of a chance to grieve reminiscing about you. I'll have her full attention, I can promise you that. After I've had my satisfaction from her, others will have their turn on her."
Richard wanted to break the man's neck.
"Think about that as your wicked soul slides into the dark, eternal agony of the underworld, as you fall into the cold, merciless grasp of the Keeper. That's where all your kind goes, to the justice of eternal suffering, and that's as it should be, seeing as how we've all sacrificed everything to come up here to this forsaken land so as we can bring divine light and the law of the order to all you selfish heathens. Your sinful way of life, your mere existence, offends the Creator, and it offends those of us who bow to Him."
The man was working himself up into a righteous rage.
"Do you have any idea what I've sacrificed for the salvation of the souls of your people? My family went hungry, went without, sacrificed, so that they could send everything to our courageous troops. My brother and I gave ourselves over to the fight for our cause and everything we believe in. We both came north to do our duty to our Emperor and our Creator. We both devoted our lives to the cause of bringing goodness to you people. We fought in countless bloody battles against those who resist our efforts on behalf of what is right and just. We saw countless of our brethren die in those battles. I saw the glory of our army of the Order continue on in the fight for salvation while your people sent the wicked gifted against us. Those gifted conjured evil made of magic. My brother was blinded by some of that magic. He screamed in agony as that magic bloodied his eyes and burned his lungs. The infections that swiftly befell him made his whole head swell, his sightless eyes bulge. He could only moan in agony. We left him to die alone, so that we could move on in our noble struggle as was only right. Your wife and those like her will now sacrifice themselves to give us a small diversion in this miserable life, as we labor in that noble struggle. It's her small payment on a debt of gratitude for what we have given over for our fellow man in order to bring the word of the order to those who would otherwise turn away from their duty to faith. Someday your sinful wife will join you there in the darkness of the underworld, but not until after we're finished with her. Just don't expect her to be joining you any time soon,
as I expect she'll be whoring for the brave soldiers of the Order for some time to come. What with how the men like to get their hands on a good-looking woman like her in order to take their minds off the drudgery of their honorable work, I expect she'll be kept good and busy, since there is so much honorable work to do.
He waggled his knife before Richard's eyes. Like this business here. With the relief us men get from her, we'll have the strength to redouble our determination to eliminate all those who will not submit to the ways of the Order.
It was insanity. Richard could hardly believe that there were men this irrational, this devoted to such mindless beliefs. But there were. They seemed to emerge everywhere, multiplying like maggots, devoted to destroying anything joyful and beneficial to life. He choked back his words, his rage. Nothing angered men like this as much as reason or truth or life or goodness. Such qualities only incited such men to destroy. Because Richard knew that anything he said would only provoke the man and make it worse for Kaelin, he kept quiet. That was all he could do for her now. Seeing that he had not goaded Richard into an appeal, the soldier laughed again and threw a kiss toward Kaelin.
Be with you shortly, love, soon as I'm done divorcing you from your worthless husband here.
He was a monster, shortly to be headed for the woman Richard loved, toward a defenseless, terrified woman who was only beginning to suffer at the hands of these brutes. Monster. Could this be what Shota had meant? The witch woman had once said that if Richard and Kaelin ever married and lay together, she would conceive a monster. They had always assumed that Shota had meant that if they conceived a child, then their child would be a monster because that child would have Richard's gift and Kaelin's confessor power. But maybe that was not at all the real meaning behind Shota's foretelling.
This is the end of disc number 6. Please continue listening on disc number 7.